You're traveling to another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are only that of the imagination. You're entering the Twilight Zone.
Imagination turned to the macabre during the spooky season. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Hope you had a great weekend. We're revving up to the big second annual Halloween Spooktacular on Friday. Yeah, thanks for the requests and dedications. They're all crammed into our crypt of goodies. But yeah, you know, if you're nice, Trudy and Aurora, they might make an exception and squeeze in one or two more requests. Details coming up. Also a Halloween appetizer. Speaking of which, Walmart in hot water over a particular advertisement for a department of costumes. Strange. We'll talk about it. Ebola hysteria hits New York. And a very prestigious public university is under the gun for an academic fraud scandal. We'll talk about that. Get you on the line, too, if you're listening live on Tuesday, October 28th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east, number in motion 347-857-4505. Twitter feed already abuzz at AB Writes, the show today being brought to you in part by Verizon Fios, rated number one for upload speeds, also by the Lincoln Motor Company. It's a perfect blend of luxury, style, and tradition. Live in your moment, take a ride with the Lincoln Motor Company. And by PopNet, new and improved, 24/7 online on the air. It's arts, culture, conversation at the new improved PopNet. So I told you on last week that we would be having a very special guest today. I think this will be an inspirational show. James Hickman is a man who has a very inspirational, encouraging story to share. He knows about conquering mental illness as both a son, a patient, and a psychotherapist. And he tells the story in this fascinating and compelling memoir called The Mindful Son, A Beacon of Hope Through the Storm of Mental Illness. I think it will sit side by side with a book that influenced me during my psychotherapy training some years back, An Unquiet Mind, by Kay Redfield Jamison, who went on to become a psychologist battling bipolar disorder. James, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your courageous story with so many people. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Amy Beth. I appreciate you inviting me to the show.
Well, very happy to have you here, and congratulations on this book, which I will say is quite brave. We talk to a lot of authors on this show, and I work with a lot of people as a creativity coach and teacher and counselor, and I always say it's important to find your voice and tell your story, and if you're telling your personal story in a form of a memoir, it really does ratchet up the courage it takes to just sit down and write it and share it. Talk about the writing of this story before we get into the actual story, because you had to relive a lot of things. Was it painful? Was it traumatic? Or was it cathartic? Or all of the above?
It was quite painful at times, but it also was cathartic and sort of gave me a chance to heal. But it was I was often tearful at times, dredging up the memories to write the book. But at the same time, I was thankful I was able to remember as much of the story as I was.
Oh yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit so people have a framework for it. You grew up in Alabama. Your mom was diagnosed with schizophrenia when you were a little boy, right? And you pretty much grew up with your grandmother.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was something of an orphan. My first memories were of foster homes. My first memories were of a foster home in rural Albertville, Alabama. And I remember getting kicked off a mule and having the wind knocked out of me and touching a fish from the pond the first time. It was all those kind of memories from living on a farm. And then I left that foster home to go live with my father and my older brother in the Portland, Oregon area. And we lived in low-rent housing there. We were very poor, hungry, experienced a lot of neglect, bullies. And so I had a rough couple of years there in Oregon. And then eventually my brother, Bert, and I moved back to live with my mother and stepfather, Dave. My stepfather was a mechanical engineer in Huntsville, Alabama. But my mother passed away within about a year of us moving back to Alabama. And so then I lived with some neighbors for a while. Eventually, my grandmother who'd been a prosperous businesswoman for most of her life, took me in. At that point, she was living on a fixed income because she'd spent so much money trying to care for my mother. And so it was with a free spirit that she took on the new challenge of raising me, a child who'd already been through a lot of traumatic experiences.
Yeah. Well, and your stepfather, we should say, also kind of remained a constant in your life. He helped finance your financially, right? And he was kind of he was in your life for a long time too, right?
Yes, he was. He was also very important to my recovery in that he really instilled in me a sense of having a scientific understanding of the universe. And this was really important to my recovery because I was able to understand how the brain operated on physical principles and how the medication could help improve its functioning. Eventually, I got to the point where I realized that I was in denial for a lot of years before I got to that point in my recovery.
Yeah, and you do talk about that in the book. I mean, you chronicle, it's very powerful, the scene where you start to first have hallucinations. You were still in college at the time, and mostly auditory hallucinations for you, right, where you just heard all these voices and you thought you could read minds. And it really must have been very scary. I mean, at the beginning, you thought it was, trippy is the word, or you thought it was enlightening. You thought you were onto something, and then it got scarier because I guess they got more pronounced, and you kind of realized that you were in some kind of a spiral, but you didn't really know what it was, even though your mother had gone through.
Exactly.
Schizophrenia.
My family had swept mental illness under the rug. They were so frightened that they'd had bad experience with psychiatrists and things, and they were so frightened of it that we didn't talk about mental illness a lot. That's probably the main reason why it took me a couple of weeks of going through all these psychotic experiences before it dawned on me that even the idea that it might be mental illness dawned on me in any kind of conscious way.
Yeah, and it's a scary diagnosis for sure. And after you got the diagnosis, you were still, as you would say, in denial, as so many people are, which is why I think it's so important that you wrote this book, because you talk about what you went through and also coming out the other end of it, which I think is so great that you've been able to do that for other people, for yourself, first of all, and then sharing it with other people, because there still is, and we've come a long way, no question, but there still is a stigma attached to mental illness. There still is a lot of ignorance surrounding mental illness. I know we did a show after Robin Williams passed away with people and the ignorant things people said about depression and suicide. It's still something which a lot of people are ashamed of or afraid of, and they don't want to talk about it. They don't really understand it. But we have come a long way, and the only way we keep getting further along is to have people like you coming out and writing books like this. So I really do want to emphasize that it's an important book for people who are suffering with mental illness or loved ones, people who are in the field of psychotherapy, and just anybody to have a better understanding of what people go through and that there is hope. Because for a long time, particularly schizophrenia, was the diagnosis that you wouldn't want to hear because it's so scary and people would think, oh, you can't do anything with the rest of your life. And I think you felt that way for a while, too. I know you were on the track to go to law school, and you tried a couple of times, right, to get into law school even after you were diagnosed. And not that you couldn't do it, but I think you found another path for yourself, that you really didn't really want to do it as much as you thought you did initially. But a lot of people get that diagnosis, or used to. Maybe now there is, because of people like you, there's more hope that when you get that diagnosis, you're pretty much confined to a limited life where you're just going to be in a day treatment center and not really get to pursue your dreams and your hopes and your intellect, which you obviously had. And so many people who do suffer with mental illness are very intelligent, very creative, very capable.
Yeah.
They just have to learn how to cope with the illness. So talk a little bit about... it took you a while, right? It took you a couple of hospitalizations to really get with the program, as you said, finally realize that you needed the medication and it wasn't a horrible, you know, Damocles sword hanging over your head.
Right. Well, I was blessed to have some good therapists that they had a vision for me of working in a professional capacity that I didn't have for myself initially after my diagnosis. And they also hung in there with me when I was going through a lot of denial. And so having good therapists was really key to my recovery. And it, another one thing about it is that people need to realize is it can take a long time. Even in my story, which was a very positive story for recovery, it took me years to get to the point where I wanted to be on the other side of mental illness. Probably the biggest turning point for me was when I ended up in the state hospital. And when I found myself in the state hospital, there were people around, there were a lot of people around me who were experiencing a lot of the same symptoms I was. I mean, we all thought we were in the mafia. We all thought we were some kind of religious figure. A lot of us thought we were Elvis. So, you know, there was no way we could all be right. So,
yeah. Well, if you have different delusions, you might be right. You know, everybody's a different character, right, or something.
Exactly. But just being in that environment was very key to my recovery. At that point, I accepted the fact I do have a mental illness, but I still needed another year or so before I realized that the medication was going to be key for my recovery as well.
Now, what is it that's so frightening? Because a lot of people have this issue, particularly with mental illness and taking their medication. What is the correlation? Is it because of the side effects, which sometimes can be overwhelming to some people, or is it because just the idea that we have to take medication to get better, or you feel better so you don't need it anymore? I mean, what is the big hurdle for people? Because that's a common issue with a lot of patients.
Well, it goes deeper than denial, Amy Beth. There's actually a condition called anosognosia, and this condition actually prevents people from being able to accept the evidence at hand that they have a mental illness. So a lot of people they're just not able to grasp the concept of it. They just don't believe it. It is an actual condition called anosognosia. A guy named Dr. Javier Amador had a presentation where he was trying to convince somebody that they had diabetes there in the audience. Of course, they were like, no, I don't have it. And he said, it's the same thing. If you don't think you have something, you're
right.
Not going to take medication for it.
So in other words, there's no real, for a lot of people, the evidence isn't there enough for them. Even if they have the symptoms, there's no real proof to them that this is what they have, and they don't want to take their medication. I mean, people who have other diseases, like diabetes or anything else, sometimes don't want to take their medication too. So it's not just mental illness. But there seems to be a prevailing issue with people, and this is why people cycle back and have problems, because they're okay while they're on their medication, and they get off it, and they wind up having problems. And, that's interesting that is one condition. Also, there are some side effects for some of these medications, which a lot of people find punishing, I guess. Is that right?
Oh,
find the right combination.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't so stubborn that I wanted to ignore everybody's around me's pleas to take my medication. So I would try to take the medication, and then I would be hit with all these side effects like blurred vision, dry mouth that was so severe that I had literally no saliva in my mouth. So, I experienced hunger as a child, and I really had food issues as a result. So not being able to taste food at all was just sort of a nightmare scenario for me. What I didn't realize is that all these side effects pretty much abate with time. And I've been on the medication for way over a decade now, and the side effects aren't nearly as severe as when you first start taking the medicine.
Well, so there is hope for people. And then you decided at some point, I know there were during the book, as I said, I really enjoyed reading it. It was painful to read in some parts because it was so tough what you went through, but also life-affirming and inspirational. You talk about at one point you were with a particular girlfriend, and she and her family talked you into trying to become a teacher, so you were going to do that. That didn't quite work out. At what point did you decide you wanted to, I think you were either going to become a teacher or a psychotherapist, you decided to go in that direction, which seems like a perfect fit for you. How did you decide to do that, and how hard was it? Because it took a while for you to get over that hurdle, too, and decide, I can really be a professional, too.
Well, I spent a while thinking about going into the teaching profession, and that was a very important turning point of my recovery, because that was really when I started saying, okay, I'm really going to have to take this medication. Because I, as part of my teaching duties as a substitute teacher, I was dispensing medication to children and giving them their medicine. So I thought, well, I need to take my medication just to be on the safe side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things sort of fell through with the teaching situation later, and due to a relationship with a girlfriend I had at that time, I decided not to be a teacher at that time. Well, for a little further down the road, I also stopped taking my medication at that point. So further mm-hmm. down the road, I found that my mind was sort of starting to deteriorate. And I said, well, I'm going to try to take the medication before things get a lot worse. And I did, and I've been on the medication ever since. So it was actually a couple more years before I would make up my mind to become a therapist. And the way that this happened was I met a young lady that had my same mental illness, schizophrenia, except she was working in a professional capacity as a software engineer. Well, this was the first time I'd ever met anybody like this, and our relationship inspired me in profound ways. I was working as a security officer at that point, in talking with her and going over it in my mind, I thought, why not be a therapist? I mean, who could do a better job at it than me? Someone that's been there, that can relate to whatever everybody's going through. And
exactly, yeah.
I had a calling to do it, and it was different from when I wanted to be a lawyer or when I thought about being a teacher. This time I actually had a dream. I mean, the idea of being a therapist really captivated me, and I really felt that that's what God wanted me to do. And luckily, I've been a therapist now for over 10 years, and I've had the chance to help countless people in their recovery.
Good for you. It's interesting because it's true the way you describe it. You wanted to be a lawyer because it seemed like a practical thing to do, and it was a thing, you know, you were a bright guy and you were in school. A lot of people decide to go to law school for those reasons, and nothing wrong with that. But I think when you went through what you went through, your illness and your recovery, I think that became so profound for you, and you did feel like you were called to it, and I think you were encouraged also by your therapist. You were nervous at first because you thought, these therapists have helped me so much, I can't be as good, but then they convinced you, right, or they helped you convince yourself, as therapists do, that this was a good path. And I think it is so empowering and inspiring for other people who are going through it. Not that necessarily your clients and patients know that that's what you went through, because you know, the therapist is the therapist, and you don't necessarily divulge all kinds of personal information, but you bring your empathy to
right,
the process.
Right. Once I make a connection with someone, then it's easy for us to talk about ways that they can heal.
Yeah, right. And you see that. You probably have a real positive vision for your patients and your clients because you see that. That it happened for you, that it can happen for them too. You know, you have that. As you said, it's a long process. It doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't happen for everybody, of course, but there is real hope, and I think people have to understand that. I think the fear comes from people thinking, oh, this is it, and it's going to be a limited life,
yeah.
And I'm not going to have that. But you're certainly a living example that it is possible with hard work, with medication, with working with the right people. I mean, it's all of those things that you need to support package and dynamic, but it is possible, and this book, I think, is quite powerful. What has your response been so far in the mental health community? I'm sure a lot of people have seen it and read the book. What kind of response have you gotten so far?
Oh, I've had some very good response to my book. I was able to have my book for sale at the NAMI National Convention. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I've spoken to a ton of audiences about mental illness. I spoke to about 250 students at the University of Alabama. I've spoken at State NAMI Conference. And I've had the opportunity to share my story in newsprint, radio, television. In fact, on the back of my book, there's you'll see endorsements by some key mental health figures, like
yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say yes. You know, you do see there are people here who are part of the Executive Committee of National Alliance of Mental Health, psychiatrist. Gentleman who's the director of Wings across Alabama. A lot of people that have had a chance to read the book, which I think is really important that you're getting congratulations for being able to do it and having the courage to tell it and share it and really, I think, transform the way people think about people who are coping with mental illness. One of the things I know in the book, a strain was your feeling when you first were diagnosed and struggling with the feeling of being other and not being part of society and being looked at differently and all of that. And I think that you've obviously come out the other side of that. And I'm sure a lot of people who feel that way will read this book and be inspired and encouraged to keep going, keep going through their journey and their process of healing and recovery. And there is something brighter on the other side. So really, congratulations, James, for telling this story and presenting it to a lot of people. I wish you the best with it. People can find out more, and I think it's an important read for anybody, really, who's just interested in a good story and personal triumph. There are a couple of places you can go. You have a website for the book itself called themindfulsun.com, and then you have your own website, which I guess talks about the book plus other work that you do, jameshickman.net. Have any of your patients read it, or is that something you don't want to necessarily...
Some of them have. Bear in mind, I have over 200 patients, so
yeah.
Even though there may just be a handful of them that have read it, most of them have it. I'm not sure that most of them necessarily realize that I have schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But the ones that have had it have thought it was inspiring and. I've gotten a lot of good feedback from them about it.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine anybody not finding it inspiring. It really is. I thank you so much for joining us. I wish you the best with the book. Again, and we'll post the sites on Twitter and Facebook. And you also have a Facebook page, we should mention, not on Twitter yet. But people can connect with you if they have any questions or comments about the book. I'm sure you're getting some great feedback. And I do appreciate it. James Hickman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thank you. James Hickman, find out more at themindfulsun.com or jameshickman.net. The book is The Mindful Sun. Very important book indeed. It's Amy Beth Arquay Show. Reach out to us via Twitter at AB Writes or the studio line, 347-857-4505.
Bless my heart, bless my soul. gotta hold on. You gotta hold on.
Brittany Howard and the great Alabama Shakes on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, as we once again thank one of Alabama's favorite sons, James Hickman, for stopping by and sharing his very courageous and inspiring story of conquering mental illness. Find out more at themindfulson.com. Speaking of mental illness, somebody passed me this article that appeared in Bustle. I guess it's an online website written by a person who suffers from depression. And she points out depression and sadness are not the same thing. Repeat, they are not the same thing. Here's what makes them very different. Everybody gets sad from time to time. That's just part of being human. Your goldfish dies, or your DVR skips the season finale of Below Deck, you're going to shed a tear. Well, they repeat the Below Deck, I'm sure, a lot on Bravo. It happens. But being depressed is different, she says, which is so key, which is something that still not everyone understands. Being depressed means having an actual illness, and one that still attracts a great deal of stigma, although more and more people are talking about their own experiences with the illness and taking it out of the shadows, putting it into the light, which is awesome. Indeed, it's important for people to understand that. But it's not just getting the blues. And a lot of people, you know, when we did the show on Robin Williams' suicide, a lot of people were coming out saying very ignorant things. How could he do it? He was selfish. All of these kinds of things, which really indicate ignorance. So as I said at the time, I'm not angry with people for having the ignorance. I just wish they would learn, expose themselves to some facts, expose themselves to people like James Hickman, who are putting their stories out there. There's a great book also, as I mentioned, called An Unquiet Mind by psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison, where she recounts her gripping battle with bipolar disorder, and she still wound up being a phenomenal psychologist. So many of people who were struck with mental illness are people with great abilities, great talents, great intellect, great creativity, and they really have a lot of obstacles and hurdles to get over that are greater than many of us who don't suffer from those illnesses. So you got to, you know, try to have compassion at the very least. That's your baseline, compassion. And some of the things that that irk this woman who was suffering from depression, when she said, people will try to help you or maybe assuage their own discomfort by saying things like, it's just the weather. And she says, yeah, sometimes it's rainy outside and that can make people feel blue. But you know what makes people feel even bluer? The idea that their emotional state and mind are a flimsy, silly thing controlled by arbitrary external factors like clouds. You know, it's not just that easy. It's not that simple. People will say things like, have you tried exercising? Exercise can help. There are things where the serotonin and all that stuff, it may release. But it's not just that. It's bigger than that when you really are suffering from depression. People chastising you, saying, hey, you don't have anything to be sad about. And her comment to that is, yeah, that's true. Congratulations. You have literally defined depression. I am well aware that everything is going perfectly for me. That's why it's such a bummer that this chemical bubble in my head is preventing me from enjoying it and also trying to blow up my life. Think about that. There's a great movie out, which came and went very quickly, but you can get it on DVD, called Helen, starring Ashley Judd, about a woman who is in the throes of a deep depression. And there's one scene, which I think just still strikes me, stands out in my head, where she's finally hospitalized. She has kind of a breakdown. And her husband, who's an attorney, says to the doctor, but she's a happy person. She has a great life. What's going on here? Why is she unhappy? And the doctor pretty much says it's not about being unhappy. She has an illness. And that's the point with mental illness. You don't always see it. People still don't get it, that it's a real illness and it has something to do with your daily circumstance. Again, the daily blues are the daily blues. And there are some depressions that can be triggered by circumstance, a circumstantial depression, and it may tie in and become a clinical depression. But a lot of people who are depressed are just depressed because it is the chemical bubble in your brain, as this woman points out. It's all in your head. Yeah, that's true. Mental illness is in my head. That's what makes it mental. And the brain is capable of many awesome things, she said, and so many awful ones too. Like, for example, the fact that your brain can make you think it was okay to talk to me in such a terribly condescending way. Yeah, I think it's good to call people out on that. People who turn it around and say things like, I was depressed once. Again, it becomes all about them. Medication will turn you into a zombie. Okay, now her comment to this is interesting. She says, we're all entitled to our beliefs. You can go all Tom Cruise-esque and frown on the use of stuff like SSRIs if you want. That's fine by me. But having seriously considered walking into traffic and ending it all before I started Prozac, and now, you know, being able to do stuff like blink and laugh at jokes, I'm going to have to go ahead and disagree with you. So before you judge other people and what they're going through and what they're doing to alleviate their own pain, be careful what you say. You're just being dramatic. Well, I don't know. You should try meditation. Meditation can help, but it's not the be-all and end-all answer. Now, she does say, I go easy on people who think they're giving helpful advice. That's because when I am depressed, I have to do things like remind myself to eat vegetables. I've absolutely been that friend who is all go drink a green juice, man, because green vegetables can act as mood boosters. So when people have told me to try yoga or meditation, I grit my teeth and I nod, understanding that they are just trying to share something that's worked for them with me. Keep in mind, this is also why I am still an ardent follower of Goop. So maybe I'm not to be trusted. Before giving someone with depression helpful advice, consider what works for you might not work for them, and that's fine. And the last one that she offers is someone who says, I think depression is self-indulgent. I'm not going to read what she says about that one. Again, it's really open up your mind and learn about it. If you know someone who's suffering from depression, and you know a lot of people are, learn about it. Educate yourself. And by all means, the biggest thing you can do is to listen. You know, I know I talk a lot. I'm a pretty loquacious free thinker, but I do like to listen, and I think that's the old thing, you have one mouth and two ears. You want to listen as much, and being effective as a counselor, being effective as a host, being effective as a writer, a lot of it is about listening. There's talking to, and you have your turn, but listen. And really, if somebody's talking to you about their experience, sometimes they just want you to listen. And if you can just be compassionate, so you don't even have to know. You don't even have to be. Not everybody has to be a trained psychotherapist. Not everybody has to read up on something to just listen. There are a lot of people who are just naturally compassionate and are great listeners and probably would be great therapists because they are just good at listening and good at offering empathy, and that's really what you want to do. But think about that before you do quick trigger advice. We're always looking for quick fixes, and we live in this kind of society where, you know, it's websites and it's links, and people look at stuff quickly, and in 30 seconds I can figure out what your deal is. I did have one person once tell me, which I thought was very fascinating, to just show how different people are. It was an actor that I had worked with on a play once years ago, and he said, well, what are you doing? What else do you do? And I said, well, I also work as a counselor and a psychotherapist. And he said, I can't imagine doing that. I don't want to hear about other people's problems. And so for some people, that's not up their alley. But if a friend comes to you and is having a problem or wants to talk about it, just have that baseline compassion, and that's a lot. That can go a long way. A little of that can go a long way. But think before you speak and give out free advice. That's what I would say. It is the Amy Bergman Show. Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes. A couple of folks chiming in via our interview with James Hickman. Ramos says, great interview. What a story. I will indeed check out the book. Well, thank you, Ramos. One of our hardy regulars, Johnny Fever's Hangover, chiming in. He says, another good interview, liking it, AB. All right, thank you, Johnny Fever. Appreciate it. And don't forget, you can catch all the show's archive for podcasts. So if you miss any part of it or want to hear it again or link it up with a website or whatever, you can do so via the Blog Talk Radio site. You can follow the Amy Beth Arkowee Show there, download episodes, also at iTunes, NetNow, and the website, amybetharkowee.com. Reach out. What's on your mind? 347-857-4505, Twitter feed at AB Wright.
And if it's bad. are enjoying the miracle of radio. Radio at its finest over frequency modulation.
Hold your head up on the A.B. Bedarkwi show as we once again thank James Heckman for stopping by and sharing his courageous and oh-so-inspiring story. Find out more at themindfulsun.com. Twitter feed busy. Nixie, one of our hardy regulars, chiming in. Another great show. Really looking forward to Friday. Yeah, our second annual Spooktacular. Trudy just gave me the go-ahead, although our crypt is pretty full, rammed to the brim with Halloween requests and dedications. There may be time for one or two more if you get them in by today. Do so via the website, amybetharkawee.com, or on Twitter at abwrites with the hashtag Spooktacular, and join us as we scare up some fun this Friday, which is officially Halloween, October 31st. So still shopping for a costume, and if you're headed to Walmart and you're looking for a quote-unquote fat girl costume, really, they have this. Walmart has everyone. Needs, especially if you happen to fall into the category known as fat girl. No kidding here, although I wish we were. Until just about 11 a.m. this morning, the mega retailer actually had a subsection of its online Halloween costumes marked as fat girl costumes. Yeah, it's an ill-advised category. The name Fat Girl still remains derogatory, although maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. And it's also unclear what the retailer's motivations were for creating such a category. Anna Merlin at Jezebel pointed out that many of the costumes featured in the so-called Fat Girl section were also available on a page labeled Women's Plus Size Adult. So was this someone's idea of a funny joke, or did Walmart actually think people were searching for Fat Girl costumes, like to dress up as Fat Girls? Now, Walmart was contacted by the Huffington Post for a comment, no immediate response, but the section was taken down after they contacted them. The Fat Girl costumes page now redirects to an empty women's plus-size costumes page. So you go there, there's nothing there. Now, in case you're not a Fat Girl but just think it would be hilarious to dress up as one for Halloween, why not try the Walmart Fat Tinkerbell group or purchase a straight-up fat suit? Halloween, brought to you by Walmart, the best time of year to make fun of any woman over size 6. So, of course, they also, sell oversized bags of Halloween candy, so never mind. But here's an update. They did say that Huffington Post received the following statement from a Walmart spokesman. I guess this happened yesterday. This never should have been on our site. It's unacceptable, and we apologize. We are working to remove it as soon as possible and ensure this never will happen again. All right. Thank you to the folks at Huffington Post and Jezebel for the story and the updates. Not good. Not sure who did it, why they did it. I guess some people think things are funny, and they're not necessarily funny. Is there anything funny about the Ebola outbreak? I mean, we had a little hysteria in New York when we had the doctor that had it. You figured that was going to happen eventually. As we said last week, a lot of people passed through New York. There was another young 5-year-old who was tested. He is negative for Ebola yesterday. But what happened to that nurse, Casey Hickok from Maine, who was passing through New Jersey, and Chris Christie putting her in a tent for the weekend outside the hospital? I mean, I don't know where I stand as far as quarantining people, and maybe it's a good idea, certainly volunteer quarantines, which don't seem to work because these people want to get out, as Bill Maher said on his show, and mingle. I mean, maybe just stay home when you come back with it. But certainly if you're going to quarantine people at a hospital, put them in the hospital. Don't put them outside the hospital in a tent with a porta potty. That was ill-conceived, and they were going to keep her there for 21 days. Fortunately, she made enough of a stink and threatened to sue, so they immediately got rid of her. And she apparently does not have. She tested negative for the disease, and she's not contagious. You're not contagious until you have the symptoms. So the hysteria may be a little outsized. I understand where fear comes from, and it is scary. But you have to balance it all and treat people with some dignity and respect as well. And Chris Christie showing his stripes as the, politician with tendency towards bullying came through again in full force. But some people find there's humor in everything, for sure. Here are the Capitol Steps.
Attention, this is an airport announcement. All incoming international passengers, please report to security checkpoints for a full body probing.
Never saw a line move slower, but everybody's had a fright. Now we're hearing from Obama that you will not get off your flight if you've got fever. It's a warning, I'm moving at a glacial pace. Fever! I left one glove in someone. Now my supervisor's on my case. Everybody fears Ebola. That's why you must remove your shoes. Well, did you know you can get symptoms from too much contact with Fox News? It is a fever. Just from watching fever as his pox takes root. Fever! We suggest you watch news in a hazmat suit. Here is something to consider when dealing with a bug that dealt the folks who steal your bottled water are now in charge of global health.
Frightening, isn't it? Capital Steps and their take on the Ebola hysteria with fever. I'm the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes and the phone line 347-857-4505. Want to give our inspiration to action shout out today to Darcy, who is working on a mixed media project and a memoir. I love people who try to do two things at once. It's great. A lot of talent out there. And she says, "It jolted me in the right direction and got me off my duff. I will give you more information as it happens." Enough talking. All right, I get what you mean. Exactly. Sometimes you talk yourself out of stuff. I've done that myself. You talk about the project too much, it kind of diffuses the energy. But good luck to you. I'm glad it's working, Darcy, and thanks for reaching out to us. If the Inspiration to Action Challenge has worked for you, by all means, please reach out to the website. I'd love to give you a pat on the back. It's amybetharkowee.com. Also, that's the place to go if you need a little cajoling in that department. I will give you a primer on the challenge, as well as any other creativity coaching and counseling questions and conversations. The first one is always on me. Hey, while you're at the website, why not find out more about the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, too? Those are my stories. And it's a great time to start because the first one, Killing Time, actually takes place around Halloween. A lot of fun there. And both Killing Time and Dead Silent are available for ebook and paperback. And thanks so much to the great response that I've gotten and the fan mail, all that good stuff. I love it. It's fun. I'm not beyond it. Believe me, I'm not beyond it. I was getting a little taken aback when I get a nice letter, but I'm not beyond it. It's a lot of fun. Thank you so much. So check that out. Hey, a lot of people are pretty much not happy about what's going on in North Carolina. You heard about this. UNC, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, one of the most prestigious universities, never mind just public universities, but in the country. Apparently they've been having a fraud scandal, which has been brewing for years, regarding athletes there. That's a big, football and basketball school, sports school as well. But a lot of these athletes have been given a pass through what they call paper classes, where they pretty much just don't have to show up and they automatically get an A or high ranking B or something to keep their average up so they can play. And it was there was a whistleblower, I guess, a teacher or tutor that was there that kind of revealed it, and she's gotten a lot of backlash because people love their sports. And it's not good, especially these colleges. I mean, you're promising something to these students. They're being paid in a scholarship in a way. So there's always this argument about whether they should be unionized and whether they should get paid. They're getting paid their education. But are they getting an education? That becomes the question. I mean, do you just want to have them as like a minor league where they get paid a regular salary and that they go on to the pros, they go on to the pros? The truth is, though, most of these people are not going to go on to the pros. So they're not going to get all that largesse that awaits NBA players and NFL players and baseball players, et cetera. These are people that are going to have to get out there in the real world and get a job, and they're not going to have an education to back them up for that job. So that's where I think the shame comes and should come from colleges, especially all colleges, whether they're prestigious or not. If you're promising the education, that education should be a component, and the kids, the students should have to take the education seriously. I mean, maybe you can have a deferred thing because they spend so much, I guess the argument is they spend so much time practicing and at sports that is like a full-time job. Maybe they should defer it. Maybe let them play and defer their education, their real education, later. I mean, there are some people, particularly in baseball, because they don't finish very often. I guess the scholarships are a little different in baseball. People will leave early and maybe go back, like Ron Darling, who went to Yale. I don't think he was on a scholarship because I don't think they have athletic scholarships in the Ivy League, but he left early and then finished his degree after the fact. So I'm saying maybe they should have a deferred program with the people who have scholarships and have them perform as athletes, as essentially employees, and then their pay, and maybe they have some funding, stipend or whatever it is, but their big bulk of their pay, which is their education, can come later after they're done. Maybe that's the answer. So they will have time to study. So it's not just that they can't do it, it's that they don't have time to do it. And if you're investing in the education part, I think the academic part should be part of it. It's just me. What's your take? 347-857-4505, Twitter feed, of course, at AB Writes. As Carolina is on our mind, maybe not for the right reasons today. Here's JT.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moon? Ain't he just like a friend of mine? He hit me from behind. Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's a silver sun. You best walk her away and watch it shining. Watch her watch the morning come. A silver tear appears. I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. dark and silent late last night. I think I might have heard the highway calling. Geese in flight and dogs at bite. Signs it might be omens say I'm going, going, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. With a holy host of others standing around me, still I'm on the dark side of the moon. And it seems like it goes on like this forever. You must forgive me if I'm up and gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like your friends of mine? From behind, yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Gone to Carolina in my mind. And I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Gone to Carolina.
Classic Badge on the ABB Berkeley Show as we remember Jack Bruce, the adventurous bassist of that so-called 60s supergroup who passed away at the age of 71 last weekend, and lots of people paying tribute to a man who was considered one of the best, if not best, rock bassists around. People like his former bandmate, Eric Clapton, wrote on his website, he was a great musician and composer and a tremendous inspiration to me. Ginger Baker, the drummer of Cream, said, "I am very sad to learn of the loss of a fine man, Jack Bruce. My thoughts and wishes are with his family at this difficult time." He also served, Jack Bruce did, as the occasional member of Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, and the Beatles drummer shared his condolences. "We lost Jack Bruce today, an incredible musician, writer, and good friend. Peace and love to all his family," Ringo Starr tweeted. He was really, as I said, long considered one of rock's greatest bassists. His style was considered adventurous, to say the least. And Pink Floyd's Roger Waters called Bruce probably the most musically gifted bass player who's ever been in his Rolling Stones 100 Greatest Artists tribute to Cream. And many renowned bassists have paid their respect to Bruce on Twitter. "So sad to hear of Jack Bruce passing, my biggest influence and favorite bass player. Thank you, Jack, R.I.P., so said Black Sabbath's Geezer Butler. While Red Chili Peppers' Flea added, "Oh man, Jack Bruce, too much. Wow, holy, holy, I love that guy. One of a kind greatness. End of an era." Well, not really, because the music lives on. And, you know, it's interesting because Cream was considered the quintessential supergroup. It didn't last too long because there were some differences, particularly between, or so the story goes, Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker. So they didn't last as long as people had thought. But their music certainly is indelibly etched in our cultural psyche, for sure, as sort of the quintessential 60s sound, and also very transformative in so many ways. It holds up. Let's put it that way. Here's another classic, "Sunshine of Your Love," Cream, as we remember Jack Bruce.
I'm with you, my love.
Tales of Brave Ulysses, the quintessential supergroup Cream on the Amy Beth Arkley Show and Sunshine of Your Love, as we remember their adventurous bassist, Jack Bruce, who passed away at 71. Rest well, Jack. Your music lives on and on. It's the Amy Beth Arkley Show. How you doing on our little motivational jumpstart? Are you cutting back on social media? I've done it a bit. I can't go cold turkey, so the social media fast is out. I just can't do it. I've got too many things to promote and too many people I'm connected with online. But I am cutting back, and I think I'm being more productive in my work. I'm not sure. We'll see. I've got to give it another week or two. How about you? Let me know it's working for you. And reach out to the website if you have any other creativity coaching or counseling concerns. The first conversation, of course, always on me. It's amybetharkaway.com. Speaking of inspirational and motivational stories, thanks again going out to James Hickman, our guest today. Find out more about his book, The Mindful Son, at themindfulson.com. I think it's an inspiring story that will help a lot of people. So if you know someone or if you yourself are suffering with mental illness, if you're a mental health provider, if you're just someone who likes a good story, this book is for you. So find out. It really does cover a lot of territory. I do recommend it. It's one of those books that really gets to you because it took so much courage to write it. I'll put up the link for the book, too. But find out more. Again, it's themindfulson.com. So Friday, we ready? Because we're going to do it. We're going to scare up some fun with our second annual Spooktacular, on this venue anyway. Requests and dedications. The crypt is crammed, but Trudy said we could squeeze a couple more in. So if you have one, get it to us via Twitter at ABWrites with the hashtag Spooktacular or the website amybetharkaway.com ASAP, as in today, because we're going to get started to load everything into the studio. And big hearty thanks going out to Trudy and Aurora in the booth. They're working overtime. Did a good job today and working overtime for Friday and MLATCS headquarters. I hope you have yourself a great week, whatever you do, wherever you go. Drive safe. Play nice, dream big, and come on back, for goodness sakes. I'm going to scare up some fun on Friday on the Amy Beth Barkley Show. Because you know I'm a witchy woman. We'll leave you with the Eagles. Take care. And maybe a bonus track or two.
Ghastly image of creaky old bones. My goodness, it's the ghost of old Dow Jones.
He did the crash.
He did the market crash.
The market crash.
He made it fall in a flash.
He did the crash.
He turned their stocks to trash.
The market crash.
Oh, he did the market crash. The specter did his dance, and the market tumbled down. And Then he spoke with a horrifying frown.
Pardon me, I know this sucks, but do you suppose I can borrow 700 billion bucks?
He did the crash.
He did the market crash.
The market crash.
Investors broke out in a rash.
He did the crash.
They all lost a ton of cash.
The market crash.
Oh, he did the market crash. Everybody's doing it. Why, here comes my broker now. Oh, nice of him to drop by.
Just think, Sally, when the creek pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch, we'll be here to see him. What's that? What's that? I hear the great pumpkin!